Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives. The author is Ellen Brown, and it is a book that everyone should read. In the solution area, we have tapped into a number of sources and resources, in particular the Thrive Movement website, thrivemovement.com. We specifically investigated into the top 10 actions, what you can do in terms of solutions. Those, as a brief review, are 1. Get informed, speak up, and connect with others. 2. Bank locally. 3. Buy and invest responsibly. 4. Join the movement to audit and end the Federal Reserve. 5. Keep the internet fair and open. 6. Support independent media. 7. Support organic non-GMO farming. 8. Require election and campaign finance reform. 9. Advocate for renewable and free energy. And 10. Take part in critical mass action. In continuation of the theme of solutions, I'd like to touch upon some specific cases in this week's show. In a famous 1969 court case, the defendant, Jerome Daly, successfully opposed the bank's foreclosure on his $14,000 home mortgage loans. Jerome Daly nearly lost his farm to a bank, but made a brilliant case. It was called the First National Bank versus Jerome Daly, defending himself and resulting in a victory. Daly argued that the bank never put up any real money for his loan. It had, in fact, created it out of thin air, therefore lacking valid consideration, an essential part of the contract. In fact, all of bank loans are essentially done this way today, as we have been discussing for quite a while. The bank's president actually confirmed this point, testifying that this was standard banking procedure, and the court ultimately ruled in favor of Daly to keep his farm. Now remember, that's 1969, and this form of defense had not been actively pursued in the past. The implications of this case were huge, demonstrating that fractional reserve lending is an illegal practice due to the fact that the banks merely put up digital dollars backed by nothing, while borrowers put up real assets, such as their homes, in order to secure a loan. What's more astounding is that If the borrower fails to make a payment and the bank forecloses on them, the bank will seize the property without paying back the borrower for the amount they've already invested in the home. In this way, banks accumulate more wealth and life savings are lost by those actually creating value in the economy. Since then, similar cases have been brought before judges, but the universal result has been no success. Several judges took an honest analysis and admitted that what the banks are doing is improper, yet they felt that the whole system of banking is based on these principles and procedures, and finding in favor of the defendants questioning the banking process would result in massive disruption of the banking system and the belief that that would ruin the entire stability of the economy. There may be multiple ways to legally oppose foreclosures, though. Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur advises, of course, getting proper legal representation before moving out of your house. And even though we've seen $850 billion bailouts for Wall Street and $25 billion bailouts for the auto industry, struggling homeowners still await large-scale government assistance. Even though the Obama administration contends it is working out details to stem foreclosures, nothing really substantial has occurred. In Michigan, Wayne County Sheriff Warren Evans announced at one point he would not enforce sales of foreclosed homes anymore. And in Ohio, Representative Marcy Kaptur is encouraging homeowners facing foreclosures to stay in their homes. Meanwhile, the government-backed mortgage giant Fannie Mae has agreed to restructure mortgages after a campaign led by one of its biggest critics, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. The unfortunate result, however, is that banks know how to play with numbers, and in the long run, on a practical level, the homeowners very rarely get any benefit. Even with a modified loan, they often, if not almost always, find themselves running into arrearages again on the loan, or when one looks at the total amount of cost of the modification, the buyer is ultimately paying a lot more for the loan over the life of the loan. There's really so much deception and sleight of hand, and on these modifications, people are trying to go through it themselves and not have legal advice to take an in-depth look at what the facts are. Also, in states like Iowa, a mortgage attempt has a number of very successful responses, such as a Chapter 13 bankruptcy to catch up on the arrears, in addition to a quite lengthy period of actually staying in the home before one's home is auctioned without even paying for the mortgage itself during that period. Again, legal advice is necessary in these circumstances, but there are strategies to deal with the foreclosure. And I'll return to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. As we talked about in other shows regarding solutions, the way we structure banks in local communities actually has shown some success both in the United States and abroad. One example is a community-owned bank of Bangladesh that takes a radically different approach to banking and has had great success. It's called a Grameen Bank, and it does what most conventional banks fail to do. It provides credit to the poorest people without any collateral. The underlying vision of Muhammad Yunus, founder, managing director, and Nobel laureate, was to lend people based on their potential rather than material possessions. Grameen Bank has followed through on that vision by adopting innovative strategies. For example, borrowers own 95% of the total equity of the bank. 97% of its borrowers are women. Loans are 100% financed from its deposits. Interest rates are low. Those with nothing are more likely to get loans than those with more. Branches are located throughout rural Bangladesh. If a borrower is having difficulty paying back a loan, the bank works with the borrower to set up a new payment plan rather than foreclose or report them to the credit agency. Overall, the Grameen Bank is a successful model that has deviated from conventional banking policies, providing more than $7 billion U.S. dollars to borrowers and lifting more than 65% of them above the poverty line. Also, when talking about banks, we have discussed how banks should be like the Bank of North Dakota. In 2008, when the U.S. and the world were suffering from the worst economic recession since the Great Depression, North Dakota's economy was thriving. Unemployment was the lowest in the nation. Housing prices were stable. Foreclosures were uncommon. There was a budget surplus of $1.2 billion, and the overall state economy grew by 7.3%. They were like the other side of the coin compared to all the other states and the banks. Well, what's North Dakota's secret? Part of its success has to do with the Bank of North Dakota, which is a state-owned bank created in 1919. It is the only state-owned bank in the nation, and the state is required by law to deposit all its funds into the bank. Its mission is to promote agriculture, commerce, and industry in North Dakota. The bank partners with other private banks to give out loans to farmers, students, and small business owners within North Dakota. The bank even returns money to the state general fund. Over the last 90 years, it has returned $500 million. This successful banking model can be adopted by other states, as we discussed, to solve budgetary crises, create jobs, increase lending, and challenge the mainstream banking establishment. In a recent article by Ellen Brown, author of The Web of Debt, and published in Yes Magazine, the article being called Bank on It, How Cash-Starved States Can Create Their Own Credit, starts with a quote by Francis Bacon, "He that will not apply new remedies must expect new evils, for time is the greatest innovator." The article says that on February 19, 2009, California narrowly escaped bankruptcy when Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger put on his Terminator hat and held the state Senate in lockdown mode until they signed a very controversial budget. If the vote had failed, the state was going to be reduced to paying its employees in IOUs. California avoided bankruptcy for the time being, but 46 of 50 states are insolvent and could be filing Chapter 9 bankruptcy in the not-too-distant future. One of the four states that is not insolvent is an unlikely candidate for the distinction, North Dakota. As Michigan management consultant Charles Fleetham observed in an article distributed to his local media, North Dakota is a sparsely populated state of less than 700,000, known for cold weather, isolated farmers, and a hit movie, Fargo. Yet for some reason, it defies the real estate cliche of location, location, location. Since 2000, the state's GNP has grown 56%. Personal income has grown 43%, and wages have grown 34%. This year, the state has a budget surplus of $1.2 billion. Well, what does the state of North Dakota have that the other states don't? As we said, the answer seems to be its own bank. In fact, North Dakota has the only state-owned bank in the nation. The state legislature established the Bank of North Dakota in 1919. Fleetham writes that the bank was set up to free farmers and small businesses from the clutches of out-of-state bankers and railroad men. By law, the state must deposit all its funds in the bank, and the state guarantees its deposits. Three elected officials oversee the bank: the governor, the attorney general, and the commissioner of agriculture. The bank's stated mission is to deliver sound financial services that promote agriculture, commerce, and industry in North Dakota. The bank operates as a banker's bank, partnering with private banks to loan money to farmers, real estate developers, schools, and small businesses. It loans money to students, over 184,000 outstanding loans, and it purchases municipal bonds for public institutions. Still, you may ask, how does that solve the solvency problem? Isn't the state still limited to spending only the money it has? The answer is no. Certified card-carrying bankers are allowed to do something nobody else can do. They can create credit without accounting entries on their books. As we have been talking about for some while, this is really a license to create money. Because under the fractional reserve lending system, banks are allowed to extend credit, create money as loans, in a sum equal to many times their deposit base. Congressman Jerry Voorhees, writing in 1973, explained it like this, quote, "For every $1 or $1.50 which people or the government deposit in a bank, the banking system can create, out of thin air, and by the stroke of a pen, some $10 of checkbook money or demand deposits. It can lend all that $10 into circulation at interest just so long as it has the $1 or a little more in reserve to back it up." End quote. That banks actually create money with accounting entries was confirmed in a revealing booklet published by the Chicago Federal Reserve titled Modern Money Mechanics. The booklet was periodically revised until 1992, when it had reached 50 pages long. On page 49 of the 1992 edition, it states, quote, "With a uniform 10% reserve requirement, a $1 increase in reserves would support $10 of additional transaction accounts, loans created as deposits in borrowers' accounts," close quote. Interestingly, the 10% reserve requirement is now largely obsolete, in part because banks have figured out how to get around it with such devices as overnight sweeps. What chiefly limits bank lending today is the 8% capital requirement imposed by the Bank for International Settlements, the head of the private global central banking system in Basel, Switzerland. With an 8% capital requirement, a state with its own bank could fan its revenues into 12.5 times their face value in loans. In other words, 100 divided by 8 equals 12.5. And since the state would actually own the bank, it would not have to worry about shareholders or profits. It could lend to creditworthy borrowers at very low interest, perhaps limited only to a service charge covering its costs. And it could lend to itself or to its municipal governments at as low as 0% interest. If these loans were rolled over indefinitely, the effect would be the same as creating new debt-free money. Dangerously inflationary? Not if the money were used to create new goods and services. Price inflation results only when demand, the money, exceeds supply, the goods and services. When they increase together, prices remain stable. And I'll come back to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So we just asked the question, was this process dangerously inflationary? And the response is, not if the money were used to create new goods and services. Price inflation results only when demand, that's the money, exceeds the supply, which are goods and services. As long as they're increasing together, prices remain stable. Today, we are in a dangerous deflationary spiral, as lending has dried up and asset values have plummeted. The monopoly on the creation of money and credit by a private banking fraternity has resulted in a malfunctioning credit system and monetary collapse. Credit markets have been frozen by the wildly speculative derivatives gambles of a few big Wall Street banks, bets that not only destroyed those banks' balance sheets, but are infecting the whole private banking system with toxic debris. To get out of this deflationary debt trap requires an injection of new debt-free money into the economy, something that can best be done through a system of public banks dedicated to serving the public interest, administering credit as a public utility. Some experts insist that we must tighten our belts and start saving again in order to rebuild the capital necessary for functioning markets. But our markets actually functioned quite well so long as the credit system was working. We have the same real assets, raw materials, oil, technical knowledge, productive capacity, labor, force, etc., that we had before the crisis began. Our workers and factories are sitting idle because the private credit system has failed. A system of public credit could put them back to work again. The notion that money is something that has to be saved before it can be borrowed misconstrues the nature of money and credit. Credit is merely a legal agreement, a monetization of future proceeds, a promise to pay later from the fruits of the advance. Banks have created credit on their books for hundreds and hundreds of years, and this system would have worked quite well had it not been for the enormous tribute siphoned off to private coffers in the form of interest. A public banking system could overcome the problem by returning the interest to the public purse. This is the sort of banking system that was pioneered in the colony of Pennsylvania, where it worked brilliantly well, and which we have discussed in the past. Now back to Michigan. Restoring Michigan to solvency, among other advantages to a state of owning its own bank, are the substantial sums it could save in interest. As Fleetham notes of his own ailing state of Michigan, quote, according to financial reports, the state of Michigan, the city of Detroit, the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department, the Wayne County Airport, the Detroit Public Schools, the University of Michigan, and Michigan State University pay over $800 million a year in interest on long-term debt. If you add interest paid by the Michigan cities, school districts, and public utilities, the cost to our taxpayers easily tops $1 billion a year. What does Wall Street do with the billion-plus dollars? They decorate their offices like kings. End quote. Now, looking at this particular case, it was interesting that the projected state budget deficit for 2009 in Michigan was also $1 billion. If Michigan did not have to pay over $1 billion in interest to Wall Street, the budget could actually have been balanced and the state could be restored to solvency. A state-owned bank could not only provide interest-free credit for the state, but could actually generate revenue for it. Fleetham notes that in 2007, the Bank of North Dakota earned a net profit of $51 million on a loan volume of $2 billion. He comments, quote, Michigan citizens paid over $5 billion in personal income tax. With a state bank like North Dakota's, we could reduce this burden, fund new businesses, and restore our crumbling water and sewer systems. And we don't have to feel sorry about Wall Street losing our business. They didn't earn the money that they lent us. They created it in computers and charged us interest to boot. Let's follow North Dakota's lead and get free from Wall Street's web. That's the end of the quote. Taking the initiative to California, they could do that as well. Robert Ellis is a Tucson talk show host who once worked on Wall Street and has been involved in setting up several banks and financial institutions. He proposed in a letter to the governor of California that California could resolve its financial woes by setting up a bank on the model of the Bank of North Dakota. He wrote, quote, "I admire your tenacity in dealing with California's financial problems. Your idea of using IOUs was ingenious, but there is a better way. The state of California can charter its own bank and issue its own checks to all state employees. It can also pay all its vendors, contracts, and contractors through the bank. Additionally, once the bank is operational, you can fund your own state projects and you determine the interest rate paid as opposed to being at the mercy of the banks you currently deal with or the interest rates the investment bankers make you pay to issue bonds. By doing this, you will put the state in control of its own destiny and make it the benefactor of its own money. What I am proposing is not new. It has been done by one other state in the nation, North Dakota. Why should you continue to pay the banks for services and interest on loans when you can receive the interest for the benefit of the state of California? Wouldn't it be better if you could fund your own infrastructure projects without having to get the approval of independent banks or investment bankers? Additionally, you set the interest rate on your own projects. You can even set it at zero if you deem the project worthy enough." End quote. Ellis offered his services in setting up the bank, which he thought could be chartered in a few short months. Unfortunately, the governor never replied, but some pressure from constituents might encourage a response eventually. Failing that, there is the initiative and referendum process pioneered in California. It allows state laws to be proposed directly by the public and the state's constitution to be amended either by public petition, the initiative it's called, or by the legislature submitting a proposed constitutional amendment to the electorate, called the referendum. The initiative is done by writing a proposed constitutional amendment or statute as a petition, which is submitted to the California Attorney General, along with a submission fee, which was a modest $200 in 2004. The petition must be signed by registered voters, amounting to 8% for a constitutional amendment or 5% for a statute of the number of people who voted in the most recent election for governor. As Gandhi said, "When the people lead, the leaders will follow." We the people can beat the Wall Street bankers at their own game by moving our legislators to set up publicly owned banks that create credit using the same banking principles that are accepted as standard and usual in the trade by bankers themselves. And again, this is an article by Ellen Brown, who, besides writing The Web of Debt, is also the president of the Public Banking Institute. And in the next show, we will look at some further examples of how the economy can be very actively affected by the root level of people at the local levels. So come back next week and you'll learn more on how to deal with debt. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.